Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Your Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Patricia Banks, who's an associate professor of sociology at Mount Holyoke College. She's written a book called Diversity and Philanthropy at African American Museums. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm really delighted to be talking to you about this book. It's an incredibly well-timed book, both in terms of questions about the future of the museum as an institution, and then also in a kind of wider sociopolitical context. And one of the questions I guess we might start with is, where did the kind of the interest in the book come from, and how did it develop as part of your sort of broader intellectual project?
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. So
great.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
That's good.
So my research really broadly is on culture, patronage, and markets. And so whereas research on cultural patronage typically focuses on social class, I also look at race and ethnicity. So my first book is Represent Art and Identity Among the Black Upper Middle Class. And for that book, I went to New York and Atlanta, and I interviewed art collectors to see how they construct their racial identity through collecting art associated with the African diaspora. And a lot of my collectors were also supporters of African American museums. And so I became very curious about why people support African American museums. At that point in time, there was also fundraising. Fundraising had really just started for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And so I thought this would be a perfect second project.
I mean, that's the institution that opens the book. And it'd be great actually to hear a bit more about, I was going to say why that institution matters, but it's really obvious why that institution matters. But why was that institution a good starting point and case study for the book?
So it's a great starting point because the National Museum of African American History and Culture is the largest African American museum in the United States. It's located in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall. And it's part of the Smithsonian complex. So it is the first African-American museum on the National Mall. Now, a lot of people, when you say, you know, do you know of an African-American museum? At this point, they do know about the National Museum of African-American History and Culture because it opened a couple of years ago in 2016. But there's actually over 300 African-American museums and related institutions across the country. And many of them have opened in recent years, like the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And we even have a few that are slated to open in the next couple of years, such as the International African American Museum in South Carolina and the National Museum, the National African American Museum of Music, which is going to open in Nashville, Tennessee. So you wouldn't have all these museums without patrons.
Yeah.
So patrons are a critical part of the story. And so the National Museum of African American History and Culture provides a nice lens for us to start thinking about culture, race, and class and patronage.
I mean, the really sort of obvious thing when you start to mention the patrons is who are we? Like, who are we talking about here? What, both what kind of people, and then obviously later in the book we'll talk about practices and relationships with the institutions, but are we talking about kind of primarily wealthy individuals? What sort of individuals?
So the patrons of African American museums as a group, and this is typical of patronage more broadly, are upper middle and upper class. Now, they do differ when we compare the patrons of African American museums to majority institutions. They tend to be, they're more likely Black. So there's a higher concentration of African Americans who are associated with African American museums. What's also important to note as well, though, and this is, of course, part of the story of the book, is that they differ in some other ways as well. So we've got a group of people who are upper middle and upper class, many of whom are African Americans, but they're also non-Blacks. Most of the non-Blacks who support are whites. So it's mainly African Americans and whites when we start to think about race. And it's also the case that a lot of the supporters are in the private sector. Yeah. But there are also people who are not in the private sector. For example, professors, people who work for government. So that's an important kind of variation that's important to be sensitive to. There's also lifestyle differences. About half of the people I interviewed are what I call cultural connoisseurs, and the other half are cultural appreciators. And cultural connoisseurs are, it's my term to refer to people whose lifestyle is very much embedded in art and culture. So they might be collectors, for example. The cultural appreciators, you know, they enjoy art and culture, but it's not a significant feature of their lifestyle. And I think that's important because when a lot of people think of museum patron, they think that everybody is deeply involved in art. And that's not necessarily the case. And then the final kind of variation that's important to be attentive to is generation. So the majority of supporters were born before 1965. And again, this is kind of typical of museum patronage more broadly, but there's also a contingent of those who were born after 1965. And so, you know, it's important for us to be sensitive to those variations as well.
And I mean, it brings up lots and lots of questions. Obviously, and they're all kind of variations of, so how do we explain this? But before we do, I was struck quite early on by this idea about there being kind of particular museum values. And I think that's really crucial to the book, actually, because these are not, I suppose, neutral institutions that are just being given money. You know, there is a sort of a specific dynamic about what these institutions are and what they do. And that term, museum values, kind of, I think, deserves to be given a little airtime.
So museum values is the term that I use to describe why patrons, how they think about the value of the arts institutions that they support. So it refers to why they think these institutions should exist, how they think about how these museums should adapt to the future, how they should be governed, how they should be organized. And of course, what I argue is that depending on their particular background, different patrons have distinct sets of museum values.
So let's get into those.
Okay.
So, I mean, the first thing that comes up is the way that there are distinctive relationships depending on race. And obviously, in the American context, like, the Brits are obsessed by class, and obviously, you know, race is one of the crucial dividing lines in American sociological analysis and in American society. And we could do this at a sort of theoretical level, but actually, one of the things I really liked about that early chapter in the book is that this is a very kind of personal human story. So you've got the example of Jennifer and Grant, and I wonder if you might tell us that story as a way of kind of unpacking these different relationships with the institutions that are kind of shaped and grounded by race.
So these, Jennifer and Grant were two of the patrons, of course everybody has pseudonyms, but they were two of the patrons who I interviewed. And let's begin with Jennifer. So Jennifer is a patron of one of the African American museums in her city. And she talked about one of the really valuable aspects of the patronage for her was the fact that she had an opportunity to interact with other African American museum, other African Americans in her community who were also upper middle and upper class. And she talked about the fact that when she was at events associated with majority cultural institutions, often she would be the only person there or just one of a few. And so the African American Museum in her city became a focal point of connection for the Black, middle, and upper class. And she described how there are few organizations in her city where all of the African Americans are members of and support, and the museum was one of them. So she really valued her patronage for the role that it played in intra-racial and intra-class connections. So really building community among the Black, middle, and upper class. Grant talked about the value of patronage from his perspective for the interracial ties. So he described one of the reasons that he got involved in supporting the museum that he gives to was he felt that there wasn't enough support by whites in the community. And he thought it was a worthy undertaking, and he thought that more whites should be involved. And so he decided to get involved. Now, one of the differences between Grant and Jennifer is that while Jennifer described the museum as a space where she was renewing her ties with people who were friends and acquaintances, Grant shared that if it weren't for the museum, he wouldn't necessarily have even come across some of the people who were there. And that's because, you know, in this city, the Black Museum disproportionately does get support from African Americans. And so for him, he really valued it as a space to create interracial bonds. And it was interesting because there were even some whites who I interviewed who, you know, in their professional lives, in their personal lives, they actually do interact a lot with African Americans. So the museum wasn't the only place where they connected with African Americans, but they too thought about its value as, for them, being a bridge between communities. So helping to connect the African American and the white community.
And I think your analysis there was particularly measured, actually, because it would be, I think, kind of quite easy to be very critical of some of those relationships, particularly in an almost kind of transactional or mechanistic way. And you sort of develop that later in the book where you consider what the more corporate or professional relationships are. And one really obvious thing is a manifestation of corporate social responsibility. So we have, you know, the backdrop of a moment where museums are being criticized for what kind of funding they take and the extent of, you know, art washing of particularly oil companies or drug or pharmaceutical empires and stuff like this. And that, I suppose, almost, you know, micro relationship that you show with Grant develops that. And it, you know, leads us to the question of, so what are these sort of professional corporate relationships with the African American Museum?
So this is a kind of an interesting part of the book. If we step back a minute, and I'll just kind of talk about the history of African American museums. So historically, African American museums, we've always, they've existed for a long time. So there were some that existed in the 19th century. But as a type of museum, they really started growing in the 1960s. And it was part of what people called the Black Museum movement. And so we see a concentration of these museums, and then we've just seen more being founded kind of over time. And so these museums in their kind of early forms were often referred to as storefronts. So it's kind of, they were small institutions. People would start them, and there were a lot of volunteers who were supporting them. So they were not like the majority institutions that were deeply kind of connected to the corporate sector. And so this is one of the kind of interesting parts of this story that you see with my book, is that you really do have a set of African American museums, not all of them, just like this is not the case with all majority museums. But with the larger African American museums, they are getting corporate donations. And so what you end up with is these museums will sometimes have very long-term relationships with corporations in some cases. So in some cases, corporations have been founding donors of these museums. And since then, they've continued to keep ties through having a member on a board, having people serve on committees, and giving donations like supporting galas. And so what I found is that for people who work in the corporate sector, who work in the for-profit sector, they often think about their patronage in relationship to their careers.
Yeah.
So there's kind of two sides of it. One is the doing good.
Yeah.
And so the doing good is that they are connecting it to the ethos of corporate social responsibility. And this is an idea that corporations have an obligation to not only maximize profit, but to also serve their stakeholders, such as the communities where they are doing business. And so for the supporters who work in the corporate sector, they would often think about their patronage at African American museums as an articulation of their companies, as well as their broader profession, kind of obligation to give back. So they would talk about it in those ways. In some cases, it was very specific to companies. So people would have, you know, their company had been a founding donor. And so someone in their company suggested, I'm rotating off the board. You know, you should, now it's a good time for you to try to get involved. So they would see it connected to their job, but then also just more broadly. So there would be business associations in particular communities, and one might get recruited because of their involvement there. So that's kind of the doing good. The other side of that is the doing well, which in that sense, what it means is that patronage offers opportunities for one to kind of network in some circumstances. So in some cases, people would invite clients to have tours of museums. In some cases, they would invite clients to fundraisers. So they would, if their company purchased a table, they would invite clients to sit at the table. And even if they didn't do that, because of the high concentration of people who worked in the private sector at these events, you have an opportunity to connect with people at your company, to connect with people at other businesses. So they often talked about it in both of those ways as an opportunity to do good, but also do well.
And I mean, these are really standard kind of stories of the contemporary museum and its struggle for money. Were there particular kind of differences around the African American Museum, or is this a story of, as you kind of gestured towards, when museums reach a certain scale, a certain position in the field, then the baggage of you have to pay for this wing, you know, comes in, and the easiest way to do that is corporate donation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really fascinating. So part of this absolutely is about the maturation of a field of museums. Part of what happens is that, you know, when you get to a certain size, there's a certain amount of resources that are required. Now, I will say one of the things that kind of complicates the situation for African American museums is, as I noted earlier, one of the key kind of groups of supporters are African Americans who are upper middle and upper class. But we also have wealth inequality, race-related wealth inequality. So what happens when a key stakeholder has less wealth? So in some ways, it's kind of interesting to think about the degree to which African-American museums, in terms of kind of organizational support, are dependent in some ways on, you know, corporations and other ways that majority institutions might not be.
Yeah. And I mean, again, you know, thinking historically, you mentioned the long-term existence of these institutions, but the comparative late arrival at the same scale as, you know, as a Smithsonian or as a Met or something like that. and you know, difficult to magic up an endowment if the action took place 200 years ago. So
exactly, absolutely. I mean, this is this book was so exciting to work on because historically, much of the research in the sociology of culture has not systematically looked in depth at race and ethnicity. But I also feel that there are so many new questions that it kind of opens up. And absolutely, when you are an institution that has been amassing wealth from particular families for decades, you're just in a very different position.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, the really obvious kind of example of that, both the different dynamics that play out through the lens of race and ethnicity, and actually a different lens of analysis, is this generational question.
Yeah.
And this is a chapter that looking over it really struck me because it felt exactly what is going on right now is in that chapter, and the sense of actually the kind of younger supporters having very distinct cultural and political focuses, relationships, and also demands of the institution. And I think it'd be fascinating to hear those differences.
As I noted early, so majority of the supporters are born before 1965, but there's a contingent of them who are born after 1965, and their museum values are different.
Yeah.
Their museum values are different. And so they tend to be more sensitive to wanting their museums that they support to be engaged with contemporary culture, contemporary politics, as well as contemporary technology. So I can talk about each of those a little bit. When it comes to contemporary technology, what I found was that there was widespread agreement among patrons that African-American museums need to situate themselves technologically to be right at the cutting edge. But one of the differences was how individual patrons themselves engage the museum. And so what I found was among the participants who were born after 1965, they're much more likely to engage their museums through social media such as Facebook, and to really feel that for them to maintain their connection to the museum, that the museums needed to highlight that.
Yeah.
So that was interesting technologically. When it comes to art, they were often more interested in museums focusing on emerging artists, and even hip-hop culture when it came to things like what type of music should be played at events. Which again is kind of interesting when we start to think about arguments about culture of poverty, so culture associated with kind of urban America, that oftentimes gets associated with continuing marginalization of those groups. And of course, there's been a lot of critique, a deep, deep critique of those arguments. But what we see here is a group of patrons, younger patrons, who very much are embracing it. So we see, kind of a melding of these two worlds. And then politically, Younger patrons are often more interested in having their museums engage contemporary political movements such as Black Lives Matters. And, you know, theoretically, what I argue is that part of the reason we see museum values differing among various groups is because of the different experiences that people have and the different identities. And when it comes to, you know, ideas about what should the museum do politically, that has to do partly because the younger patrons are more directly involved in some of these political movements. So they are involved themselves, they have friends who are involved, and so they're very aware of them. And when it comes to their kind of broader lives, they see the museum as a space that is appropriate to kind of engage them.
I mean, you can sort of speculate a little in terms of, you know, if something like the National Museum had existed in, you know, sort of middle 1960s, you might have had similar struggles over content, but the lack of that formal institution didn't give that opportunity. So in some ways, we're kind of, I suppose it's like a testament to, again, the institutional status that means you can have these struggles, but they're struggles nonetheless.
Absolutely.
And they're, you know, over both, you know, content, space, about relationships. And that kind of sense of different tastes and relationships comes through in the distinction you mentioned much earlier, which is connoisseurs and appreciators. And I was sort of struck by those two terms. And it did lead me to wonder, not just kind of what they are, because again, you've touched on that, but the sense of like, how does that work? Why are there these kind of different modes of engagement?
And so what's one of the key, well, so partly, so if we think about kind of why are there these modes of engagement, part of it is, again, when we start to think about the broader lifestyle that people have. So when it comes to, for example, a collector, you have a collector who collects perhaps historical objects related to African-Americans in the United States, or they're collecting African-American art, you know, they kind of bring that interest and that taste to their involvement with African-American museums. And so they are very conscious about things such as the role of African-American museums and valorizing culture associated with the African-American museum, with things such as the position of African-American museums in the broader field of museums with respect to status, as well as African-American museums in relationship to one another. They're very sensitive to those types of issues and have some very clear thoughts about kind of the appropriate direction to take. In contrast, when it came to appreciators, would often make statements such as, you know, I'm very passionate about this museum, but it wasn't the collection that brought me here. I'm here for other reasons. And then when I would ask them to comment about, well, what direction should collecting take? What direction should exhibitions take? They were more reluctant to comment about those things and would say, I trust the curators, versus the connoisseurs would have very clear opinions about, you know, exhibitions that they thought were well done, artists that should be collected, artists that should not be collected, the types of objects that are appropriate for the museum to collect, the types that are not. So they would often, some would even say, if they were on the museum board, that they thought that they had that role and that other people, including sometimes staff, would even look to them to play that role. Yeah.
That's really interesting. And it particularly, I guess, kind of sets up all the way through this, I've been gesturing to how of the immediate moment this book is, and how well timed it is, which is a minor miracle considering how long publications take to get out and stuff like this. And I'm struck, you know, we're recording this in New York, and there's been a series of kind of controversies over New York's cultural institutions, not specifically African American, about how they will be funded, what they will be representing, what, you know, what goes in, and, you know, who their audiences are. And I guess, where do you think the book? What do you think the book tells us, or where do you think the book fits in with this kind of contemporary discussion in terms of the sort of the future of both philanthropy, and then this kind of contested but important term of sort of diversity in the museum sector.
I think in so many ways, I think African American museums offer a lot of insight on issues that are being dealt with across the cultural world. And even when we start to think about issues such as being inclusive with respect to audiences, African American museums have been grappling with and negotiating those issues since they started. Because why did these institutions start? Part of the reason they're starting is because, you know, in the 1960s, majority museums are not as kind of inclusive when it comes to audiences from racial and ethnic minority groups, when it comes to art associated with racial and ethnic minorities, and when it comes to the leadership. And so African-American museums have really been pioneers when it comes to including racial and ethnic minority cultural producers, when it comes to the patrons, and when it comes to audience. So I think in many ways, African-American museums offer a nice model to look to. I think one of the really critical issues going on is diversity on cultural boards. Recently, a study showed that in the United States, close to half of all museum boards are all white in the United States. And it's what I think my research shows is that we really need to have diverse museum boards because people bring different perspectives to museums based on their race and ethnicity. And so to that end, some exciting developments have been, I think three foundations came together recently. It was the Ford Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, and the Alice Walton Foundation. They came together to support efforts by the American Alliance of Museums to help diversify boards. And so I think efforts like that are very important. So, I mean, it's exciting to see that a lot of stakeholders in the museum world are concerned about these issues. So I think that's one thing that's important. I also want to note, though, in the chapter on race, I also talk about ethnicity.
Yeah.
So in at the very end, I talk about ethnicity. And I think this is also an important point to bring up when we start to think about policy.
Yeah.
Because when we're thinking about diversity and cultural patronage, we often think about, for example, people of African descent, it's African Americans. And what I found in my research is that the museum values of first and second generation Black people in the United States. So, for example, people who are from Africa, from the West Indies, either they or their parents, think about the value of African American museums in some ways that are different than third generation and beyond Black people. So, for example, they are often particularly sensitive to board diversity with respect to first and second generation. They're often sensitive to audience. To what degree is our audience ethnically inclusive, particularly given the fact that in some of the communities that these museums are located in, there are more and more immigrants. And then also the content of, for example, exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So having exhibitions that speak to first and second generation people of African descent. So I think that's actually another critical issue when we start to think about diversity and the cultural world more broadly. There's a lot of, we start to think about race and ethnicity. We need to be attentive to diversity within racial and ethnic communities with respect to generational status.
I mean, the book is just, there's a wonderful illustration of the depth of the topics and data actually that the book contains, and we've only really sort of scratched the surface of it, so it seems a bit sort of mean to kind of say, so what are you doing next? but you thinking, I mean, there's a lot more you can develop here, or are you going to be doing something slightly different?
Well, you know, it's really one of the nice things about my kind of research agenda is all of the projects really build on each other and grow out of it. So as I noted earlier, I became curious about museum patronage because many of the collectors I interviewed were supporters of African American museums. And what I found in the course of this research is that many of the supporters of African American museums are corporations. So the next project, the project that I'm working on now, I'm writing a book on this topic, is looking at corporate support of Black culture. So that includes not only corporations that are giving donations to museums, African American museums, and other cultural institutions, but also looking at corporate sponsorship of Black music. So across the kind of Black cultural sector. And what I'm finding is that corporate support of Black culture is what I call a form of diversity capital. So this is a term that I developed in, as I've been working on this project, and I refer to diversity capital as cultural practices and values that allow organizations to solve problems and leverage opportunities related to race, ethnicity, and other social differences. And one way that Black cultural patronage does this is it allows corporations to signal that they value diversity and inclusion. So it allows them to construct a public image which demonstrates that they do value equity.
And I'd assume there might be some tension between their actual practices and those signals.
Well, it's interesting because there is, whenever we start to think about kind of public image, there can be moments when there's a crisis. For example, and I term them racial image crisis, when you might see patronage in particular to respond to that crisis.
But that's hopefully for the next podcast.
Yes, absolutely.